Welcome to episode 302 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Juliana Ramsey.
And today we are joined for the first time by Emily Kubinkanik. Oh, got it. Did I get it?
Yeah, that was right.
All right. I almost missed the last one. Emily, thank you so much for joining the pod today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today we're going to be doing movies that we saw this week in part one, and in part two, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1927's Metropolis, which I am very excited to dig into. Real quickly, head over to cinematary.com. We started on Monday. Yeah, Monday of this week, our Pride series. We're going to be having one of our LGBTQ plus writers writing a review of a queer movie that they like each day throughout the month of June. So we had our first one. Ash Baker wrote about A Single Man, the Tom Ford movie from 2009. So you can find that, as well as a link to a number of other LGBT films that we have written about in the past, in case you want to go through the archives. We also have a recap of the 2020 Chattanooga Film Festival. Reed Ramsey and I took part in the virtual film festival that went on a couple weeks ago. I talked a little bit about it on the pod last week, but definitely check it out. There was some good, interesting films there. And we talked a little bit about the whole virtual festival experience, which was a whole strange thing, but kind of cool. But let's go ahead and jump in the movies that we saw this week. I am going to kick things off. I technically rewatched this movie for the second time in a month. I don't think I talked about it on the podcast before. And that is the 2010 film Unstoppable by Tony Scott. It stars Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, as well as Rosario Dawson and Kevin Dunn. And it's a pretty simple movie to follow. It takes place in central Pennsylvania. And there is a train that has a bunch of deadly chemicals on it. It naturally gets loose and becomes just like this, you know, careening death machine train that is just running toward the city in Pennsylvania that, of course, has like this whole nuclear setup thing. So it's just an over-the-top explosion waiting to happen. But luckily, Chris Pine and Denzel Washington, who Denzel Washington plays the kind of weathered, he's been doing this railroad gig his whole life guy, next to the rookie Chris Pine, who's just been doing it for a few weeks. They have a little bit of a, that whole thing going on. But at the same time, you have this train that's barreling toward this city, and they are on the same line as the train and are able to get to it. It seems like plot-wise, like that would be something silly. But I've watched this thing twice. I think it's fantastic. It seems to be a very slept on action movie of the 2010s. I know we just recently, earlier this year had the whole 2010s recap of just the memorable movies. And I kind of feel like this one needs to be on there somewhere. It's so incredibly streamlined. Like I said, that plot's pretty simple to follow. There's a train that's loose and Denzel and Chris Pine are able to, try to stop it. What's so interesting also is that it just kind of breaks down that, with a lot of, it seems like with a lot of these blockbusters today, it's like we have to, install like layer after layer after layer of different, connections and points of like what we're trying to make with these villains and these, overarching goals in the movie. And this one, it's pretty simple because the bad guy of this movie is just a corporation that's trying to take the easy option out, which I feel like is something that everybody can get behind, that's the evil thing in anything. So really,
universally,
exactly.
Good, evil. It, train runaway, not good. No, don't need twists. Don't need turns.
No.
Just a big train off the tracks.
Big train, and the CEO guy is kind of an asshole, and you're like, yeah, boom, we can all get behind that.
Perfect.
Yeah. And that's what's
exactly.
And that's what's great about it. Yeah, like it's like Tony Scott really, he kind of has that he has this very distinct style to his movies. I don't know if you've ever seen anything by him, not just something like Top Gun, but even something, you know, stuff like Crimson Tide and Enemy of the State, where he just has this very distinct style to him. I think that you know, somebody like Michael Bay is very indebted to Tony Scott, but Michael Bay is kind of Tony Scott, like taking it up 20 to 50%. And Tony Scott, I think there's something really, you know, it something almost throwback to it. Again, like I keep harping on it, but like it's just so it's so weathered down that, you know, there's not really any of these complexities. And because there's no complexities to it in terms of like just the narrative structure, it's able to weave a lot of these really, it kind of just uses these like I said, these universal points of, you know, you have this evil, you have this kind of corporation that is just neglecting the what the people who are working on the ground think that they should do, and come up with a plan that of course doesn't work, and they come up with another plan and it doesn't work, and they're costing themselves money and lives. And you know, it leans on these kind of tried and true things that we kind of encounter every day in order to make, and I think that's kind of what sucks you in, because there is this like familiarity to it. But if you're looking honestly for one of the, I think it's definitely like in the level of the, of like, when it comes to the blockbuster action movies, it's up there with, you know, a Mad Max or a Speed Racer or a John Wick, you know, with these, like, I think it's very much up there as like one of the best Hollywood outputs for action in the last decade. So it's on HBO and HBO Max and those places right now. So if you're looking for just a really, really satisfying popcorn movie that also is just really smart, Unstoppable 2010, check it out. It's fun, you know, you got all the stuff, like I said.
Yeah, Father's Day's coming up, so watch it with your dad.
It's a great Father's Day movie. This is tailor made for like a like a Saturday afternoon on TNT, let me tell you. But I'm gonna toss it over to you, Emily. You caught I think this movie came out last year, but I feel like a lot of people slept on it, and now it is available to rent for free.
Yeah, I think it actually came out like really early this year. You know what? I don't remember, but
it's very, very recent.
Yeah. Just Mercy, which is free to rent on Amazon, iTunes, on demand right now. And it's about this true story about Bryan Stevenson, who is a attorney who works with wrongfully convicted felons on death row. And it's about this, he's played by Michael B. Jordan, and he is just starting out in this movie, and he's trying to get a man off of death row, who's played by Jamie Foxx. And I mean, it's very applicable to right now. That's why they put it for free. But it's just a really good story. I think, I know I've been into like in wrongfully convicted things in true crime. There's this, The Innocence Files is on Netflix, and it's about the Innocence Project, who basically does the same thing. And it's just fascinating to me that how often this happens. And a lot of the time, true story movies like this are pretty dramatic, and I think they like stretch things sometimes, but this one is pretty true to the real story, and I think the performances are really great, and it's just a really good watch right now. I really liked it.
Yeah, I had heard about it. It played here locally at the film festival, but that was really the last time I heard of it. I mean, I think it played maybe in theaters for couple weeks late last year, but it kind of was one that went under the radar, but has like a lot of you know, talent behind it, because you have, I mean, Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx, and then you also have the guy who directed it did the Brie Larson movie, and so, you know, it's like,
yeah, and she's in it too.
Okay.
Oh, Unicorn Store? Is that the Brie Larson movie?
No, what's the Yeah.
What's it called? She was like the director for that or whatever.
I'm gonna look it up as I'm gonna know it immediately, but I'm gonna look it up as you talk. But no, it has like some short-term 12. That was it.
Oh yeah.
The director of short-term 12, who I think got some acclaim for that. So it's not like it's a bunch of nobodies. It's it's a pretty loaded cast and crew. So it's kind of strange that kind of went under the radar.
Yeah, I think it would have done really well in award season, but I think when it was released, which I think was at the beginning of Black History Month in like February, it was too late. And I think if it would have been released in November or something, it probably would have done much better, which is sad, but I hope people are able to watch it now.
Yeah, it's free, so definitely check it out. And actually, the next movie you're going to talk about is actually now free as well if you have the Criterion Channel, because the Criterion Channel just opened up their entire library of films related to, or made by Black filmmakers or starring Black actors. This one, the Black Panthers documentary by Agnes Varda, is included in that.
Yeah, it's only like 28 minutes long, so it's a short watch, but it's really fascinating. I think Varda has a way of capturing real life unlike any other director, and I think the way that she was accepted into this community in order to tell their story in a global audience is really fascinating, and yeah, it's just really cool. I think it's interesting to see the similarities in the way people are organizing now as they were back then watching this film. So it's definitely something else that is applicable to right now, too.
Very cool. If you have not seen like the list of films, including this one that Criterion is offering for free, I would check it out because it's a lot of really great ones, including some that we've talked about on this podcast. So you had one more movie that is also a relatively new release.
The Vast of Night just hit Amazon Prime Video. And I know it had been playing at a few festivals, but it's a pretty small independent film. It's about these two young teenagers who one of them works for a radio station and the other one's a switchboard operator, and they hear some weird things on the radio, and it's very much like Twilight Zone 1950s sci-fi. And I don't know very much about like supernatural sci-fi radio shows of the era, but I think they drew a lot of inspiration from this. But it's really good. It's a solid independent movie. It's like 90 minutes, which I love. And I don't know. I feel like it's something different in the genre for sure. And I think the screenplay was really good as well.
Yeah. I think I've seen, it kind of looked like it had, I think this is the same one. It was going off of that kind of 80s vibe aesthetic kind of thing, at least maybe in the poster or whatever. I don't know if it's the same movie.
Mm-hmm. The poster looks like it more. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been hearing about this movie, recently, and, it's good to know. It's a good watch. Put it on my watch list.
Yeah. It's just kind of crazy that there's new releases that we can talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
Julianne, I'm going to end it with you. You had a movie that you wanted to talk about.
I'm really still on my vampire thing. Last time I was on, I talked about Interview with the Vampire, and this one, I watched Vampire's Kiss from 1988, starring a super duper young Nicolas Cage. I think he was fresh out of college in this movie. I ran up on this one not knowing that it is a cult classic. It just looked like cheesy 80s Nicolas Cage vampire, and I was like, that checks so many boxes for me. But a lot of its legacy, if you've like never heard of it before, is actually memes. Like, if you've ever seen the picture or the gif of, like, Nicolas Cage, and he sort of, like, has this, like, leering, sarcastic face. Once you see it, it's impossible to describe an image, but you've seen it, it's everywhere, and it's from this movie. It's basically, like, Vampire American Psycho. And if you've seen, like, other Nicolas Cage crazy performances, like, this was the genesis of that kind of acting style that's, like, over-the-top, crazy faces, like, shouting and screaming. His accent, someone described it as vampire because it'll go between American and British and, like, Trumpy New Yorker and sometimes all in the same sentence. So it's, like, described as, like, a horror comedy, which is pretty accurate, just because the first time you watch this movie, like, his performance is, like, staring into the sun. Like, you cannot see anything else. You can't turn your eyes away from it. It's just so insane and intense and hilarious. But, like, I watch it 2 times in one day because I'm, you know. Wow. I watch it by it's myself quarantine. In the morning and then immediately called on my friends and said, we're watching this tonight. But once you kind of, like, get used to, like, his over-the-top kind of performance, it's actually, like, a really interesting, like, well-written movie about, like, toxic relationships and trying to live up to people's impossible standards. And, like, there's one of the big plots of the story is Nicolas Cage's character's relationship with this woman named Alva, who is, like, a secretary in his office. And he's, like, throughout the movie is trying to get her to find this contract out of, like, thousands of papers. And he just, like, tortures her the whole movie. And, like, there's this particular scene where he starts screaming her name from his office. And then he comes out, jumps on top of her desk, and then chases her into the women's restroom. And it's, like, you kind of want to laugh because he's so over the top. But also it's just, like, so terrifying because, you know, once she gets back to the desk and, like, kind of the heat of the moment is over, her coworkers are like, he's so eccentric. And there's, like, a later scene where he's, like, talking to, like, the other executives in the company or whatever, and they're like, ha ha ha, heard about the thing you pulled with Alva. I love a little office theatrics, you know, keeps things interesting. And he's, like, never punished for it goes to crazy lengths in the movie. I don't want to spoil anything. But I think that's the reason why, like, Nicolas Cage's, like, over-the-top performance works is because there's, like, a commentary about power and, like, he can get away with acting like that because he's a upper-class, you know, white guy. He's the boss. But Alva, working absolutely as hard as she can, like, faced with this impossible task, is, like, always threatened to be fired or, like, something worse. Like, he physically threatens her. And that kind of, like, power play is, it's very darkly funny. So I would definitely recommend it. Watch it with your friends and laugh your ass off and then watch it later and be like, actually, this is kind of good. And then, oh, I have to find it. But I was reading an article about this and there was a particular, like, thing about the production. The production was a really interesting story because it was a huge box office flop and basically tanked everyone's careers but Nicolas Cage's. But there was an interesting thing. Give me a minute to think about it.
I know that, I think, like you had mentioned at the beginning, the only the only thing I know about this movie is, like, the Nicolas Cage face gif that is associated with it. And so it's good to know that it's actually, like, a pretty entertaining, worthwhile movie to watch as well.
It created so many more memes than that, like, some that I didn't even recognize, but when I was watching my friends, they were like, oh, that's where that came from. But also there's scenes of it that I've never seen before that I'm, like, astonished have never really gone viral, like, are so crazy. But I just have to read this, like, word for word. It's from an article from The Ringer, but it's talking about one of his, like, co-stars, his, like, vampire girlfriend. Apparently he was, like, very, like, didn't really like the actress, and they were very cold, and they had to do, like, love scenes. But here's a quote. Cage eventually warmed up to Beals, but his methods remained bizarre. Quote, to get turned on, Nick asked to have hot yogurt poured over his toes while he was doing a love scene with Jennifer, Shulman recalls. Nobody could comprehend why yogurt got Cage aroused, but the crew obliged. If you see it, if you see the shot, you don't see his feet, Shulman says.
Oh my god.
And if that doesn't sell that. You, what do you want?
I mean, I just have written in my notes, Nicolas Cage hot yogurt toes, and like...
There's not enough of that in movies already, so you need to enjoy it when there is it.
Exactly. I just, that was one of those things that you are reading an article about something, and that just stops you dead in your tracks. So watch this movie. It's on Amazon Prime, I believe.
Very cool. Yeah, I might. I think the yogurt toes, big time. But yeah. There's other other qualities that seem like that's very much going to my watch list soon. Cool. I'm gonna bring us home real quickly. I forgot that I'd watched these and wanted to mention them. One, because I want to mention that if you have not, seen a Studio Ghibli movie or are curious about some of the ones that you might have missed, while I would not, promote giving like giant companies like HBO a bunch of money, HBO Max is pretty nice because it does have not all but pretty much most of the Studio Ghibli movies and is going to be rotating those through, and that's the only place on streaming that you can find those, so that's just saying that. And so because my family had gotten HBO Max and I was looking through the Ghibli library that they had, I decided to revisit one and watch for the first time another two films by Isao Takahata, who is the other director, along with Miyazaki, who created the studio. The first, I think we've talked about a couple times already on Cinematary, but only yesterday. It's set in 1982, and it follows Taiko, who is a 27-year-old. She's not married, and she has lived her whole life in Tokyo, and so she decides to go visit kind of her extended family out in the countryside for a vacation. And while she's heading out there and performing the various acts out at the farm, she has all these memories that flood back from her I think it's her eighth grade year, and some of the connections between her at this point in her life as well as her when she was in eighth grade, with various crushes and memories and stuff between her family. And so it's a very it's very much in that mold of like it's not a movie that necessarily needed to be animated, but really has this sweet lyricism to it, and is very much like when you watch it, you understand like why it needed to be animated, because it just kind of has these floating fantasy moments that are so wonderfully drawn and done. And so if you really want just like this incredibly heartwarming coming of age story, I would recommend checking out Only Yesterday. The other one though that I saw that I believe was a TV series in Japan, and they kind of brought it together into a feature film. I might be wrong on that though, but I think it's something like that, by Takahata later in the 90s, called My Neighbor the Yamadas. And it does kind of have this disjointed nature to it. It feels almost like you smacked a bunch of, not really episodes of TV, but almost like kind of just different bits almost from this animated family. And so it just kind of that's pretty much the runtime runs about a little over 100 minutes, and it's just kind of bit after bit after bit of these various little adventures that this family has. And it breaks kind of from the traditional Ghibli animation structure, but is kind of this really fun, wild somewhat forgotten when it comes to a lot of the Ghibli features that come out, especially the ones even by Takahata. I really was appreciating his style while watching these two, and how he utilizes like, and he does this as well in like Princess Kaguya later on in his career. But I like that he has kind of this white space outside of the animated block, and he kind of utilizes having that white space as kind of this open this kind of open space to interpretation, as well as just it really focuses in on the action that's taking place within the animated portion. So if you get HBO Max or are curious about kind of looking at some non-Miyazaki kind of hidden gems within the Ghibli library, I would check out My Neighbor the Yamadas as well as Only Yesterday. So good stuff. And HBO Max, I mean, again, I'm not telling you to get it because, you know, don't give money to big corporations, but it also has a nice library.
Ghibli movies.
It has a nice library. It has Ghibli movies and it has like all of the Looney Tunes cartoons. Oh, so, I mean, those are those were like two giant selling points to me.
Yeah.
So, all right, we're going to take a short break and then we will be back talking Metropolis after this. Hello, Cinematary. This is Zach, your host, and I'm going to use this midpoint in this week's episode to let you know a little bit about what's happening on both the website and the podcast. So first off, I know for a very long time we asked you not to give us any money. Well, things have changed. We want that money. I'm just kidding. We just want like $5 a month for the rest of your life. But we're doing a Patreon, and I promise this is all in good fun. Patreon.com/cinematary. I'm sure you've heard us mention it at the end of the episode. We are doing this in order to pay for our writing that is happening on the website. We have a wonderful breadth of writers who are all giving a lot of time and effort to come up with reviews and share their thoughts on the website. And so we wanted to just give back to them in that way. And so that is why we created our Patreon page. So again, for $5 a month, you can get exclusive content from the staff. Right now, we have our hit series Film Theory and Chill, which takes a piece of film theory each month and then deconstructs it in a way that makes it a little bit more accessible. And then we end that episode usually with just us rambling about whatever is on our mind at that period of time. It's for some people, I guess. but you can find that on patreon.com/cinematary. Please consider, you know, making that donation each month just to help show these writers your appreciation for what they do. Another easy way to kind of keep up with what's happening on Cinematary is signing up for our free newsletter. So if you missed an episode, if you weren't paying attention to social media and you missed maybe a review or something, or a video essay or something that we posted, this is an easy way to keep up with all of that. So each Sunday we send out a note. It goes straight to your inbox. It gives you the latest podcast episodes, you know, what's happening on the Patreon page, and the last two reviews that are on cinematary.com. This is a great way to keep up with what's happening, and it's a nice way if you forget to go, oh, hey, I'm not, you know, just chilling out on a Sunday. I'm having some coffee, doing Sunday things. Here, I'm going to check out what Andrew wrote about something, or what Nathan wrote about something. Just, you know, we got that stuff going. So you can find that on the website, cinematary.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. Again, it's free. And finally, the easiest way to support this show is to go on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and review. You know, this is just how the algorithms work. I know every show asks you to do this, but honestly, if you could take, 30 seconds to a minute and do this, it would greatly, you know, help us. I mean, this helps us just as much as, you know, signing up for the Patreon or letting people know on social media that you listen to Cinematary and you enjoy it. All of that stuff is very helpful. So give us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast, and, you know, share it on social media. Let people know that Cinematary is around. So again, consider donating to Patreon. That's patreon.com/cinematary. Sign up for the free newsletter and then give us a rating and review on your podcaster app. Well, that is way too much of me talking. You're about to hear more of me talking, so I apologize in advance, but thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show. 2 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1927's Metropolis. Directed by Fritz Lang, from a script by Lang and Thea von Harbaugh. The film stars Bridget Helm, Gustav Froelich, Alfred Abel, and Rudolf Kleinrog. This influential German sci-fi film presents a highly stylized futuristic city where a beautiful and cultured utopia exists above a bleak underworld populated by mistreated workers. When the privileged youth Freider discovers the grim scene under the city, he becomes intent on helping the workers. He befriends the rebellious teacher Maria, but this puts him at odds with his authoritative father, leading to greater conflict. Which you can't not know that it's his father, because they always refer to him as Freider, Joe Freiderson's son. Like, it just seems like a weird, like, you have to, like, they really harp that in the intertitles. It's really funny. The film's plot originated from a novel of the same title written by Harbaugh for the sole purpose of being made into a movie. The novel is in turn drew inspiration from H.G. Wells and Mary Shelley's works, along with other German dramas at the time. The novel featured strongly in the film's marketing campaign and was serialized in the journal Illustriertes Blatt in the run-up to the release, and Harbaugh and Lang collaborated on the screenplay derived from the novel and several plot points and thematic elements, including most of the references to magic and occultism present in the novel, were dropped for the film. The screenplay itself went through many rewrites and at one point featured an ending where Frieder flew to the stars. This plot element later became the basis for Lang's Woman in the Moon. The time setting of Metropolis is open to interpretation. The 2010 re-release and reconstruction, which incorporated the original title cards written by the screenwriters, did not specify a year. Before the reconstruction, Lottie Eisner and Paul M. Jensen placed the events happening around the year 2000. Giorgio Moroder's rescored version included a title card placing the film in 2026, while Paramount's original U.S. release of the film takes place in 3000. A note in Harbaugh's novel says that the story does not take place at any particular place or time in the past or in the future. Shooting of the film was a draining experience for the actors involved due to the demands that Lang placed on them. For the scene where the worker city was flooded, Helm and 500 children from the poorest districts of Berlin had to work for 14 days in a pool of water that Lang intentionally kept at a low temperature. Lang would frequently demand numerous retakes and took 2 days to shoot a simple scene where Frieder collapses at Maria's feet. By the time Lang was satisfied with the footage he had shot, actor Gustav Froelich found he could barely stand. Other anecdotes involve Lang's insistence on using real fire for the climactic scene where the false Maria is burnt at the stake, which resulted in Helm's dress catching on fire, and his ordering extras to throw themselves towards powerful jets of water when filming the flooding of the workers' city. Helm recalled her experiences of shooting the film in a contemporary interview, saying that, quote, the night shots lasted 3 weeks, and even if they did lead to the great dramatic moments, even if we did follow Fritz Lang's directions as though in a trance, enthusiastic and enraptured at the same time, I can't forget the incredible strain that they put us under. The work wasn't easy, and the authenticity and the portrayal ended up testing our nerves now and then. For instance, it wasn't fun at all when Grote drags me by the hair to have me burned at the stake. Once I even fainted during the transformation scene, Maria as the android is clamped in a kind of wooden armament, and because the shot took so long, I didn't get enough air. The Machine Mensch, the robot built by Rot Wang to resurrect his lost love Hell, was created by sculptor Walter Schultz Mittendorf. A whole body plaster cast was taken of actress Bridget Helm, and the costume was then constructed around it. A chance discovery of a sample of, quote, plastic wood or a pliable substance designed as wood filler allowed Schultz Mittendorf to build a costume that would appear metallic and allow a small amount of free movement. Helm sustained bruises and cuts while in character as the robot, as the costume was rigid and uncomfortable. Metropolis features a range of elaborate special effects and set designs, ranging from a huge Gothic cathedral to a futuristic cityscape. In an interview, Fritz Lang reported that, quote, the film was born from my first sight of the skyscrapers in New York in October 1924. He had visited New York City for the first time and remarked, quote, I looked into the streets, the glaring lights, and the tall buildings, and there I conceived Metropolis. Although in actuality, Lang and Harbaugh had been at work on the idea for over a year. Describing his first impression impressions of the city, Lang said that, quote, the building seemed to be a vertical sail, and very light, a luxurious backdrop suspended in the dark sky to dazzle, distract, and hypnotize. He then added, the sight of New York alone should be enough to turn this beacon of beauty into the center of a film. The original premiere cut of Metropolis had been lost, and for decades, the film could be seen only in heavily truncated edits that lacked nearly a quarter of the original length. But over the years, various elements of footage had been rediscovered, and on July 1st, 2008, film experts in Berlin announced that a 16mm reduction negative of the original cut had been discovered in the archives of the Museo del Cine in Buenos Aires, Argentina. The negative was a safety reduction made in the 60s or 70s from a 35mm positive of Lang's original version, which an Argentinian film distributor had obtained in advance of arranging theatrical engagements in South America. The safety reduction was intended to safeguard the contents in case the original's flammable nitrate film stock was destroyed. The print was Lang's full original, and with about 25 minutes of footage, around one-fifth of the film, that had not been seen since 1927. In 1984, a restoration and edit of the film, running 83 minutes, was made by Italian music producer Giorgio Moroder, who paid $200,000 for the rights, outbidding his Cat People collaborator David Bowie for it. Although Moroder initially intended only to create a new soundtrack, he was surprised by the lack of a definitive print and expanded his project to a major reconstruction. Moroder's version was tinted, featured additional special effects, repleted inner titles of character dialogue with subtitles, and incorporated a soundtrack featuring songs composed and produced by Moroder and recorded with popular artists such as Freddie Mercury, Bonnie Tyler, Pat Benatar, Adam Ant, and John Anderson instead of a traditional score. It was the first serious attempt made at restoring Metropolis to Lang's original version, and until later restorations, it was the most complete version of the film commercially available. In 1927, the New York Times called it a technical marvel with feet of clay. H.G. Wells said in 1927 that it was foolishness, cliche, platitude, and muddlement about mechanical progress and progress in general. Fritz Lang himself said in a later interview with Peter Bogdanovich that, quote, I didn't like the picture, thought it was silly and stupid. Then when I saw the astronauts, what else are they but part of a machine? It's very hard to talk about pictures. Should I say now that I like Metropolis because something I have seen in my imagination comes true when I detested it after it was filmed? So, on that note, let's talk a little bit about Metropolis. And Emily, I kind of wanted to start with you because I know that kind of digging into the silent and black and white archive of movies is kind of your passion. And so had you seen Metropolis before? And if not, I mean, what did you make of the film?
I had seen it before, but it's been a really, at least like 4 or 5 years. And so a lot of it I had forgotten, and I'm pretty sure the version I watched before was not the complete version that I watched this time. But I love Lang's like later movies, especially the film noir movies that he did once he came to Hollywood. But I think this one is just unbelievable to look at, which I think is very important with silent movies. And with the absence of sound, the visuals need to be outstanding, and I think that like definitely holds up in this movie.
Yeah, we can talk about it later, but I mean, this is very much the chief inspiration for something like Blade Runner, and I think is kind of one of the most referenced back, you know, in terms of like visuals films, probably one of them of all time, just because I think it the visual style of it really like sets the benchmark for science fiction in movies. And that's what's kind of so visceral about it, because yeah, this is 1927, and it's not to say that a lot of movies around that time looked bad or anything. I mean, we talked about Seventh Heaven last week, and that's a movie that really has these kind of striking visuals for what it's trying to do, but there's something about Metropolis that's so different from everything else, even today almost.
Oh, totally. I feel like it also just has to do with, like, these are all, like, from what I could tell, at least, and from what I read, like, all constructed, like, fictional places. Like, even the, like, church that's supposed to look old is like fabricated specifically for the movie. And that's just like a very interesting thing. And like, I think it's one of the things that helps like unify the way everything looks in the movie, even though there's such kind of disparate locations, and the like undercity where all the workers work looks so different than the upper city, or like the new Tower of Babel and like all these crazy locations.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what did you, Juliana, what did you make of the movie? Because you mentioned us, and this is something that I would love to talk about for a little while, but this was your first silent movie. And so, I mean, what was that experience like? And I mean, what did you think of the movie?
It was a difficult watch, which is not a negative thing towards the movie. It's more of a me thing where I am also like incredibly ADHD. So the fact that there was no dialogue, and also I watched the shorter version of the movie, which is almost like 30 minutes shorter. But it's still like 2 hours long. So I definitely had to pause and, you know, like run around. I'm like the dog scratching at the door, wanting to go for a walk, basically. You know, holding my laptop, pacing while I'm watching this. But the thing that like drew me to this movie, that hasn't like drawn me to movies before or silent movies before, is partially because I think it's like the oldest movie I've ever seen, but also like the set design, which is like kind of my specialty. I'm a sculptor, and like the like hearing you talk about the like plaster like mold that they did of the body to like make the like robot suit was really interesting, because my specialty is in mold making, and I just like it makes my head spin, like how complicated and how labor intensive that must have been for them to create, and how great it looks.
Mm-hmm. That's such a such an evocative scene. One, when they first like reveal the suit, but then also after they've like transferred her consciousness into the suit, and it kind of like mm-hmm. does like those like first step things. It almost has like that effect of, you know, I'm thinking of like the James Whale, like Frankenstein, when you're first, you first see Frankenstein, move for the very first time in that movie. It just kind of has like this, it's just this really powerful moment, just because of the way that they act the entire like movement of it.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense like that the, costume was so stiff. Because, like, the way that the robot, like, moves is so haunting, because it's, like, it's not necessarily, like, super mechanical, but it's also not super, like, Star Trek someone in spandex. Like, it's this kind of weird, like, it seems almost supernatural. And so I really loved that part. And also just, like, when she's, like, getting her consciousness transferred, and there's all the, like, light effects and all the gears and like mechanical stuff like throughout the movie, those are very cool. I especially loved the machine that like, oh, what is the son's name? It's not Friedrich. It's something very similar, but anyway, Frieder, that's what his name is. But Frieder is like, oh, I'll take your place and work for you, when he's switching places with the factory worker. And it's like almost like a big clock where he has to like move line the hands the, to like yeah, where the light bulbs are lighting up.
yeah,
it's one of those things where I love very specific set pieces like this, because it does not matter what the machine does. Like, it is purely something that is aesthetic, and it's just like such a fun and specific like piece. And also, like, as a silent movie actor, like, you have to act so exaggerated that like that is the perfect kind of design thing, where you have to like throw your body to like move this machine and like emphasize how difficult, you know, the work is. So,
and it's also one of those where you can like even though it's silent, you can hear like the hands moving, or because I was reading a review on Letterboxd after I finished watching, and they were talking about how they're like, you can hear like the clock hands move, and you can like feel and hear the steam whenever the, you know, they have those moments where like the steam comes out of the different machines. It's even though it's a silent movie, you kind of can hear everything that's happening. For lack of a better phrase, it's a very loud silent movie, because you really do hear all of the different emotions and sounds of like this very mechanized world. Emily, I'm curious, as somebody who really like focuses in on kind of the TCM layout in classic movies, just kind of hearing Juliana's kind of recap of trying to watch silent movies. I mean, what's some advice, or what did you make of that whole experience of kind of diving into silence for the first time?
I couldn't imagine this being the first one that I ever watched, just because it is so long. I mean, like, one thing I love about old movies is they're pretty quick, most of them, especially pre-code, like before 1935, are under 90 minutes. And so this one is not a testament to all silent movies, for sure. But I think, like, this era of German expressionism in silent movies is really cool. So if you, like, enjoyed the look of this film, there's a lot of early horror movies. Nosferatu, it has a similar huge set and everything, and that's a silent movie that I think would be, you know, cool to follow this up with.
I would also say if you're looking for set design, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is an easy one.
Oh, yeah, definitely on my watch list. Also, really, really fast sidebar that I forgot to mention earlier, but in Vampire's Kiss, Nicolas Cage credited like a lot of his like acting style to silent movies, like the exaggerated expressions. And also in the movie, you see him watching the Nosferatu silent movie.
Oh, wow.
I thought that was a cool touch, which is part of the reason I wanted to bring the movie, and then I completely forgot to mention it. But I'm definitely...
Came first full circle.
Yeah, there you go. Plugging it all back in.
No, I would recommend, especially for like set design and stuff, German expression. You can't beat German expressionism and the different things they were doing at this period of time. So this is kind of late German expressionism. This is kind of on the tail end as German cinema like kind of has its moment post World War I, and then starts heading into much more of the state propaganda stuff that World War II entailed.
That sweet like Weimar Republic spot.
Yeah, exactly.
German art, yeah.
And allegedly, I guess he wasn't watching the movie correctly, but allegedly Hitler said that this was one of his favorite movies and wanted Fritz Lang to make movies for the Nazis. But I don't, if you know, we could talk about like the message of the movie. I don't know if that's what, you know, he was, you know, what Hitler was going for, but you know,
I heard that before I watched the movie, and I'm like, you know what? I could kind of see why he would like this movie. Not because that's, I think, necessarily what the movie is trying to say, but I feel like he could relate or like impress himself on the character of like Frieder. Is sort of like, oh, I'm this like revolutionary connecting the people and this highbrow.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Know, which is, in my opinion, delusional, but I could see how he could think that.
Yeah. What did you all, because I like this movie a lot. I did a video essay 2 years ago and talked about German expressionism movies, and this was definitely one of the ones that I took away as like one of the favorites that I had watched. But at the same time, when it comes to like the plot, it kind of goes kind of a little bit all over the place. It's a little radical for its time. I saw some stuff where a lot of people, kind of contemporary audiences, rejected it for the kind of communist messaging in it to an extent. But, you know, I like the radicalness of the plot, but I also don't really... don't really go for the you need the you know the mediator in between the you know the corporation and the labor that whole message. So I'm curious what you all made of just the overall narrative and messaging of Metropolis.
I know for me it is like one of those kind of movies that is very radical and very centrist at the same time, because I think, at least for me, like watching this in a modern time, it's like, oh, cool, the like fascist's kid is going to be the representative for the people. Like, that seems kind of, that seems kind of not right. Yeah, so like that is sort of seems backwards to me, but I can absolutely see this. I mean, it is like a very like rise up against, you know, class warfare kind of story. But yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I was expecting when I first watched this to be more radical than it was. And I feel like the reason why people like Hitler and really now you can kind of fit any story to the plot of this, just because it is pretty generic in the way things unfold of like an uprising, and it's like not really specific to any specific cause or anything. So that was interesting to me, but I think the thing that surprised me the most was like the false Maria part and like how much sexuality was in that. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, in the club
yes,
sequence, yeah,
which I had completely forgotten about the first time I watched this, and I don't know, I felt like that was super fascinating to watch.
I was gonna make a comment about that because I was like, this is not necessarily a judgment, or not a judgment, or this is just more of a comment, because I mean, this is like pre kind of feminism, or you know, like second wave feminism, all of that kind of stuff. But I was like, for having essentially one female character, they're real efficient and just hitting all of the blockbuster like female movie character tropes.
Yes.
You've got like you've got like the dead backstory mom, you have the like crazy slut, you know, of the like evil Maria, you have the damsel in distress, you have the like
the Madonna,
like the innocent to like prophet who's like, no, please don't do violence. Like, they just really hit all of those, you know, having basically one female character. So yeah, that definitely stood out to me.
I think it's extremely fascinating the fact that the novel was written by a woman and the screenplay was co-written by a woman. All those things in this movie, I don't know. I just would love to hear her words about the story.
Mm-hmm. Cause because
it's a little tough, just because I know I read that she had been married to Fritz Lang at the time, and then I think they got divorced, and so I'm sure he's not like singing the praises of his ex-wife post them, and he's already not singing the praises of this movie, so
yeah.
You'll never know. But sorry, I interrupted you, Juliana.
Oh no, I was just I was gonna say, yeah, I think it would be interesting to kind of see, cause I feel like at the beginning of the movie, when like, and my, I guess, modern, like, perspective on movies and plots and tropes, when they introduce Maria's character, I was like, oh, she's the mediator. Like, she's this prophet or whatever. And then I was like, oh, yeah, women didn't have agency in movies for, like, many more years after this. So that's probably not going to be the kind of thing. But it is an interesting, like, modern movie-going expectations versus, like, what were the tropes and what were the kind of cinematic shorthand at the time.
Emily, I'm glad you mentioned the club sequence where you have the evil Maria and she's doing some, if you look through Giphy for Metropolis GIFs, it's just a bunch of GIFs of the Maria dancing sequence where she has like that headdress and everything. But yeah, you're right. There is like this, you know, in a, you think of like sexuality in just any kind of national cinema at the time, you know, in America or in France, you know, predominantly. But there is kind of like, you know, somewhat of this repression. And this one is like this, it almost feels like it kind of leaps off the screen as like this really overt, overly, and then, you know, overly sexual scene, because you also, like, you have her dancing, but then you also have the whole cross-cutting and, you know, kind of overexposing and superimposing the different faces, and just like the whole sequence of like the men reacting and then her dancing and the cross-cutting is just it like just the editing in it makes it even more sexual than it already is.
Yeah. And for me, sorry.
Go ahead, Julia. It was just like I found it so hilarious because, I mean, obviously sexuality is different on screen now, but she like barely wiggles her hips and the guys in the audience are like screaming and crying and like it seems like they're like leaping over each other. And that was just like sort of a hilarious scene. But yeah, I mean, like, it is like, I guess, about the sort of like crazed ecstasy of like the whole interaction.
Mm-hmm. For me, it reminds me a lot of during this time and even into like late 1940s, a lot of people or women of color were only performers, and there was a lot of like exotic feel to like her dance and like the headdress and everything. And so I wonder if that had any influence on how they constructed the scene.
I think that there were like underneath her kind of stage, I don't remember if it was like a painted set piece or if it was real people, but I think that there were like a bunch of like African-American men like kind of holding her up, like what are those things called where you like carry someone on a bed, but anyway. And I noted that was like, I mean, every other character and extra of the thousands of extras were all white. So that was definitely something I noted when they were like, oh, an exotic dancer. You were like, mm-hmm, I know what's about to happen.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think ecstasy is a good word to like describe it. And I forgot to also mention, because you're not only having the men at the club, but you're also cross-cutting back to Frieder, who's like in bed, like almost having like this almost orgasmic reaction where he's somewhat, because he's not there, and it's almost like kind of a vision type situation, but he's like having this very like orgasmic reaction where he's like lifting out of bed, and he has the people next to him kind of reacting to that, and you just have that all with like this kind of almost like traditional, but also like kind of club-ish music, you know, heavy drums and stuff, at least on the modern score that they use, kind of, you know, going back to like what, you know, where they're kind of basing a lot of this, the dance routine off of. We talked about it a little bit at the top, but I think it's worth looking at, you know, kind of getting a sense of what everybody felt of the set work and just kind of the design of the entire world. I mean, Juliana, you mentioned the robot character, but also I'm thinking also just kind of the setting of this, because this is a very expansive movie. You know, I was thinking a lot like in the last sequence where Frieder is like chasing after Maria, and then they're having like that large chase, and like the spaces that they're running through are like pretty big. It's not like you know, a huge small hallway, yeah, or an alleyway or something. It's like these like large expansive, you know, it feels like it is like in the middle of a city. But also just like the way that they kind of introduce the setting, you know, you have that new Tower of Babel like in the middle of and you can tell that it kind of has this, it's a painting, but you know, the movement of like the various trains and planes and cars and stuff to it kind of gives this 3D life to that whole setting. And then you also have just the underground world, the machinations of all of those different machines. You have that sequence very early on where Frieder like makes his way down there, and you see like all the various workers kind of working in clockwork going left to right with the the different gears, and it leads to that whole fantasy sequence of like them being like offered up to the to the machine. But just like there's something very like transfixing about that automation, you know, as they hit left to right, you know, in you know, syncrasy, just all of those different things like makes it feel so like this, it feels so large. You know, it was a pretty large production already, but even compared to other stuff that you're seeing, it, I mean, going back to the whole comparing it to other stuff at this time, like this thing feels like it was being filmed in an actual like futuristic city, not, you know, in Berlin in 1927.
Yeah, I think that I love the intro of this movie where you're just seeing the shift change of the workers, where they're just like heads are all down. And you can tell that probably they were like counting out beats for everyone to like choreographed move at the same time, like feet in line, almost like an army. And it is very like you immediately kind of understand like, these are parts of a machine, you know? It's just, I think it's the scale, like, really helps with that. Like, the shots are so far away and so huge, and there's so many people that it just kind of is like that, you know, like that repetition just kind of washes over you, and it's overwhelming. And so, like, that was a great, like, kind of beginning of the film and the people working. And also just, like, the back and forth, like, crossfade in between the giant set pieces of the machine and the like temple of them being sacrificed is like completely insane. Like it looks so natural, and it was really just so satisfying to see where they had been like, okay, these are kind of the greater shapes of this set piece, and then how can we make it something similar? So, you know, with the face, like when I was watching it, it took me a minute to realize that the face of the like temple was not like actually a part of the machine, just because they just fade into each other so perfectly. And so, yeah, I really love that aspect.
Well, you kind of like you like look at that compared to like the kind of, you know, Greek Roman vibes of like that kind of garden area that you first meet Frieder in.
Yeah.
Where and they're kind of like frolicking just around. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it starts in a similar way to the when they're showing the Undercity, where it's like kind of a high up large camera, but it's also like it's so much brighter and white and there's less people. And so it just like creates this instant contrast. And that reminded me, it kind of reminded how in like, you know, a more modern kind of class warfare type movie, Parasite, how he kind of talks about like with his set the idea of like the rich having access to sunlight, and that's like part of privilege, and like poor people being resigned into basement, into underground spaces. And so I thought that was a really cool kind of parallel.
Emily, what did you make of the kind of design of the setting? It's kind of then you also almost have like these kind of traditional places, like the lair of Rotwang, the inventor, feels very much more like traditional German expressionist, like fairy tale location. So you just like have all these, it feels like this fully realized, varied cityscape.
Yeah. I mean, I adore Art Deco architecture, and so I think a lot of the huge buildings and like kind of background to the machine and other things, it's just so cool to see. But I even think that like the stuff where they're building the robot and everything, when Maria is like running and she gets trapped, like those hallways and everything, they feel a lot like other German expressionist movies for sure. Yeah,
the catacomb chase sequence. Yeah,
yeah.
The lighting and stuff in that is so incredible, because it just feels like it almost has like this, it almost like has this cartoon feel to it, because you like whenever the light shines on her, it that's the only thing being illuminated in the entire space. You don't see like any walls or crevices. Like it's just like pitch blackness, and then boom, a light on her, and then she'll run out of it. Like that whole sequence was really it seemed like somewhat of a precursor to what Lang would do later in Hollywood with a lot of his noirs.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
To kind of incorporate, the film noir genre with the German expressionism kind of backing of that.
I feel like he brought a lot of the lighting that he had been using decades before noir in this movie, which is pretty fascinating to see, and I didn't really notice, especially in that scene that we were just talking about. But even in the dance club scene, I think the lighting on her dancing is pretty interesting to look at in reference to film noir.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned, that there's kind of like some modern parallels with something like Parasite. That was something that I was thinking about, was that Parasite's kind of a good example that people would probably know, that you could kind of get an idea of the whole design of the city compared to the underworld in this movie. But I also feel like this is actually kind of an apt, perfect movie to be watching in the time that we're at in 2020, where you have like these large protests and uprisings around the country, very similar, especially just in terms of like politically how it's being painted. I didn't realize, until, of course, being, watching a lot of these protests and stuff take place. And then you have that sequence in the movie where they go to Joe Friedersen, the fascist leader of this entire city, who and they say that he tells the I forgot, one of the workers, just let the uprising do whatever they want, just let them do, go wherever they want and do what they want, which kind of confuses him. But it's later revealed that he's like, yeah, I'm going to do that so that, once they start tearing stuff down and breaking stuff and I have an excuse to target them, then I can do that. Like, he's looking for an excuse to send his forces against them, which is very relevant to, something that we're seeing right now just on the news, that a lot of cities kind of have that, where you have these peaceful protests and then later that night, tear gas and rubber bullets are being shot. I mean, watching this movie in this kind of cultural climate, I mean, what were you thinking, kind of the comparisons to what's happening right now in Metropolis?
I was struck by the fact that I was like surprised, I don't know, that they needed a mediator. I was like, why can't they just revolt? Like, and when false Maria is
right,
preaching to them and like telling them to do all these things, like, to me, I was like, they want her to be evil and everything, and I was just like, I just feel like this is a better way of doing it, but whatever.
She's got some good ideas, guys.
Right,
but yeah, it was pretty, I don't know, it's always satisfying to watch the anger and like the feeling that you have represented on screen in some way, even if it has nothing and it was like told in a long time ago. So it was satisfying to watch for me.
I think for me, watching this in the context of, all these Black Lives Matter protests happening all across the country and the heated debate about like peaceful or riots, or riots bad or riots good, that kind of thing. It was interesting that in this narrative, because the evil Maria, like, quote unquote, like, tricks them into destroying like the heart machine or whatever, and that causes the undercity to become flooded, and the like protesters, like the people who work in the factory, think that their children have drowned, and so there's kind of like a narrative like punishing them for destroying these machines, where it's like, well, that's why you shouldn't do violence. It's like, it's you know, it's going to reflect bad on you. It's going to hurt your family. It's going to hurt your community, like that kind of thing. And that was like a very interesting kind of, I guess, assertion to make for a movie that is seems like it is so pro, like, you know, like rise up against the people, like rise up against these machines that are hurting you. For them to be like, well, actually, I think violence is bad. Don't do it. Ew, icky, you know? I thought that was kind of an interesting
yeah.
like, plot device, I suppose.
And you had mentioned it earlier, but I think that you're right that you can see why somebody like Hitler would relate to this, because like in terms of like the political moment at the time of the movie coming out around that time, I mean, that's kind of what... That was what at that point what the Nazis were trying to kind of harp in Germany, where they get it, Germany gets out of World War One, they're completely decimated, they have no economy, they have no all of their culture, everything has just been decimated from the war, and they're especially angry at the, you know, the French and the British and the Americans, you know, post treaty that I know I saw some you know, people talking about how Fritz Lang kind of modeled a lot of the narrative off of, out of, you know, American capitalism and American, the American military and just the American government, in America, as he described an American fascism that he was seeing, you know, overseas. And then you have somebody like Hitler who, you know, you easily can kind of persuade the public to see somebody like, you know, see like the United States as the kind of metropolis city and these, you know, post-World War One lowly Germans as the factory workers who are looking to uprise. And I feel like at the same time, like at that period of time, they were doing like you just described, Juliana, and going, I mean, I don't know about the mediator thing. That seems dumb, but everything else I'm you know, I'm right. on board with. And so it's kind of interesting how those two parallel.
It reminds me, I was trying to look it up earlier. I couldn't find the quote that this is wow, what am I saying? I couldn't find the book that this quote is from. But there's an interesting quote where it's like, I remember when I was in school and we watched Bambi, and my like middle school bullies cried like when, you know, Bambi's mother was shot and like all this kind of stuff, where it's like everyone sees themselves as the victim and the hero, even though, you know, it's like, no, you guys are bullying me. But you know, everyone sees them as the hero of their own story. And so Hitler, I think the comparisons would be kind of lost on him, because he's like, no, I'm the mediator. I'm helping these people rise mm-hmm. up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Metropolis before we head out? Hopefully, Juliana, you're going to be watching more silent movies after this. Hopefully this didn't like cut you off. Okay,
for
good.
Sure. Yeah, I was like, once I saw the length of this movie, I was like, yeah, I guess I'm just kind of going in the deep end. So yeah, there's some Charlie Chaplin movies which are much lighter fare that have been on my watch list for forever. So I'll definitely have to get into those. And also just like, as you guys said, like German expressionist set design, like that kind of stuff is infinitely cool. I also love like retro futurism. It's just like such an interesting like aesthetic, and that is this, obviously. So yeah, I'm not scared off.
I'll say that Nosferatu and Caligari, I think Nosferatu might be a little bit longer, but Caligari is like an hour, so
I think it's not bad. One to follow up is Fritz Lang's next movie, M, after this one, is so amazing. So good.
Yeah, that's a great one. I like...
Okay.
Both of those movies are good, but yeah, M's terrifying today. I would recommend going in not knowing anything about it. I'll just say that.
It was on Criterion Channel for a little while. I don't know if it still is.
Perfect.
Or not.
I'll lock it away. Actually, I'll put it in my letterboxed. save it for later.
You know, that's we We usually are directing people to...
I'm sure we can do that on the podcast all the time.
We just go, hey, if you got to see... Especially now where there's, you know, libraries aren't open and you can't go to the movies, like, you got to do what you got to do.
Not condoning doing some sneaky internet things, but... Yeah.
Emily, anything from you? Any last thoughts on Metropolis?
Not really. I mean, I guess one thing I love about this series is I think... people who don't watch old movies most of the time think that you can't really glean anything from them to better understand what's going on right now. And I think this is definitely a testament that that's not true and that old movies can do that. So,
absolutely. That's why we, last week when we were just going, oh, we're going to watch Metropolis, I was like, that's not going to be relevant in any way. You know, it's like... Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm like, of course it's going to be very relevant, because I just remember from the watching it the first time, and I was like,
and then
you know,
here
I had
we
not,
are. Yeah,
it hadn't
yeah.
clicked until we were talking about it at the very end of the last podcast, and I was like, oh, there's a giant riot to end that movie. that's going to be incredibly relevant. So yeah, no, this is one that's kind of one of those.
yeah.
Cat, shut up, man. this is one of those, it's like one of the kind of post the well-known, you know, classic movies. It's always on that list of like, you have to kind of see it. And I think it's one that does live up to being, kind of one of those, you have to see it movies. Sometimes they can kind of let you down, but this one absolutely, I think, lives up to that.
It's like, you know, the required reading at school and you're like, man, I'm going to hate this. And then you, read it and you're like, I'm going to read this 4 more times.
Yeah. No, exactly. So.
Definitely.
Cool. Well, I believe that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we post all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Also, you can find us on Patreon if you're a fan of the podcast and would like to support it. We just recently did one of our Film Theory and Chill episodes. We talked about Cinema of Attractions. It was a good chat about piece of film theory that is also, speaking of accessible, you know, films, history, knowledge, and stuff, that's another accessible thing if you're not super into film theory. But thank you so much to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Hell Yeah Small World, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Matthew Lingo, Pedro Serafin, Ron Hayes, my favorite, the kittiest of kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week, we will be continuing Young Critics Watch Old Movies with 1934's The Black Cat, which Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, and a black cat.
I saw recently that Bela Lugosi like didn't have a car and he just like had roller skates that he could attach to his like brogues or whatever. And so what's up, Bela Lugosi?
You know, you gotta get there. So, you gotta get places somehow.
Exactly.
But this is one that feels very, very, very much inspired by. You know, some of the movies that we mentioned in this one, at least especially in the German cinema movement, The Black Cat has a lot of that as well. Well, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week.